The things we all carry is a podcast about first responders and their stories surrounding trauma on the job. The intention of this podcast is to raise awareness and share meaningful conversation around a subject often viewed as taboo or simply ignored. Be aware this content may be graphic and it is real. It may not be suitable for children or adults triggered by this subject matter. All right, guys, today we're talking to Robert. He's out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's been 19 years in EMS total, and he's 17 years with his department. Currently, he's a paramedic lieutenant, and you guys might know him better as the administrator behind the page of @SkullsForHope on Instagram, and he's also connected with Next Rung. And I'm going to let him talk a little bit about those as we get through the story. But for now, I'd just like to let Robert introduce himself and talk about his family history, maybe some professional history, and we'll get into the story. How you doing, Robert?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here.
As you said, I've been a first responder for a total of 19 years. And as far as my story goes, people probably don't really want to hear why I got into the job, but I think it's always the same for almost all of us that kind of want to do more, want to help people and just make a difference in any way that we can. And that was my main goal. And I think things started out pretty mundane for about the first 7 or 8 years of my career. And about, I'd say, gosh, now, what would that be doing the math? 11 years ago, or a little bit more, I had the little girl that drowned. And I think those of us that have done the job long enough can probably pinpoint the one particular call that we went on that was different or changed things for us, whether that be bad habits of self-medication, whether that be flashbacks, new diagnosis of PTSD, whatever you want to call it. It was the drowning of a little girl that was the same age and size as my son at the time. So she was 3 years old, and I don't know, there was just something about it that really stuck with me. And she was the beginning of the flashback. She was the first pediatric call I'd ever had. And for those of us that have been on those calls, especially when you have children, it just doesn't make sense to me. It's one of those things that, like, visually, even though I've seen quite a few since then, I don't know, they don't connect to me. It's not something that you normally see or that should happen. I think we can justify when you respond to an adult that's passed away, maybe our logical mind thinks, oh, they're an adult, they've had their lives, they've lived their lives, or whatever else. And it's easier to process. But with her, I just couldn't let it go. And around that time, I didn't know what to do to look past that. And I wasn't going to counseling at the time, which was actually what part of what saved my life and put me in the right direction, was going to counseling. But back then, it was an even bigger stigma than it is now. And I'd always had something on my, whether it was a Livestrong bracelet or a rubber band or something like that. And it calmed me down to make my own bracelets. And when I was making those bracelets, I came across the meaning of the skull in the Tibetan culture, which was the impermanence of life. That everything that lives dies, and you have to live every day to its fullest. And so that really hit home to me with the job that we do. And so in the bracelets, I started integrating a skull in each one, hence the name Skulls for Hope, which at the time was nowhere near existence, nor did I ever want it to be at the time. But it was something that I had that I could wear, something that was concrete that I could touch and recenter myself in those bad moments. And for a very long time, that was a very private story, and I was convinced by some friends that the story needed to be shared. And I honestly didn't think anybody would really care about what I used to call my silly bracelets, but it's created a community, and it's nice to have it. We tell our brothers and sisters, I'm here if you need anything, I'll reach out to you, or reach out to me if you need anything. But a lot of times when we're in crisis, we don't do that. We don't reach out. And this gives you something concrete to have. I know that I've, in the moments I've had panic attacks or been in a horrible situation, that I can touch it. I can run it through my hand. And it helps to remind me that I'm not alone, especially now with the community growing like it is. It's just a constant reminder and something physical that you can touch when people have challenge coins or you have a necklace that's been handed down to you, something that's concrete that you can touch. And I keep using the word concrete, but it's just something hard, something you can hold on to. So that's the start of that part of my journey. And it sounds tidy to say that and to say, oh, everything's great now. But I had a very hard time after she drowned. And I'd go on more calls, obviously. The job doesn't stop. And I wish I could tell you that it was just like, oh, cool, I made bracelets and everything was great. But it absolutely wasn't. I still struggled. I think that was the beginning of self-medicating. When I was having the flashbacks, I wasn't used to it and I didn't like it. And I just wanted to sleep when I went to bed. I didn't want to see her and remember every part of that call. And so I was drinking NyQuil. And it's funny how our logical mind works, because I knew that was a bad thing. I knew that drinking cold medicine to sleep wasn't really accepted, wasn't really a normal thing to do. But what's one thing that is readily available that everybody does that there's not really a stigma behind? And that was alcohol. And so I think that was the start of me using alcohol as self-medication. Obviously, we all drink and like to have fun and enjoy ourselves with friends. But that, I think, was unbeknownst to me at the time, was the start of my transition to alcoholism. And I think it was manageable for a few years, but for whatever reason, the more that I advocated, the more that I put myself out there, I think the more vulnerable I felt, and I didn't know how to handle it. And so probably about 4 years ago plus, I did local TED Talks. And before that, I had shared my story pretty regularly with other first responders or people that I thought might benefit from some of that. This was the first time that I ever did it publicly, like with people that just I had no knowledge of or just complete strangers. And I kind of just turned the corner with my drinking after that and just really went from once, twice on my days off to every single day off. And it just got to the point where unintentionally I was grenading my life. I was ruining relationships. I hurt people that absolutely shouldn't have been hurt because of my drinking. I put myself in dangerous situations. Those calls that we respond to, I think that we have that mindset, as most people do, that, oh, I'm just a block from the house, or I can have one more drink, or I can do whatever else. And I was basically playing with fire, no pun intended. And so a little over 2.5 years ago, I finally had enough. I, like I said before, hurt some people that I shouldn't have hurt and did some pretty horrible things in my mind. And instead of waiting for the other shoe to drop, I realized that it was time for me to get help and that I couldn't do it by myself, which is, I know I'm going all over the place with it, but kind of the point of this, kind of the point of doing this podcast and what your mission is and what all of our kind of collective mission is, that it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to talk about your issues, whether it's individually to somebody or sharing your story. But the more of our brothers and sisters that know that they're not the only ones suffering or the only ones going through something, I think the better. And two huge stigmas, I think, to the general public are alcoholism and rehab. And unfortunately, I did both. I shouldn't say unfortunately, because rehab actually saved my life, along with the community, along with family that still cared about me, and along with the counseling that I continue to go to. But point of all that is, it's a lot of work that you have to put in, but it's very worth it. When we go through these things, I think it's a heavy burden to not talk about the struggles that we have and try to hide them. And the more that we do it, and the worse that it gets, and the easier it is to see through it, I think that burden just becomes overwhelming. And I lost 3 friends locally over the last 3 years to that, I guess, burden, if you want to call it that. And I just think that mental health is such a complex thing. And I think asking for help personally is a strength, not a weakness. And I've just been blessed. I've been very lucky to meet people like you, to be a part of organizations like Skulls for Hope and Next Rung. Next Rung is actually the place that found my rehab facility. And I went there, and I've been sober now for a little over 2 years. And I can tell you that I used to say I was lucky, but I think I'm very blessed in that the last 2 years of my life, not only through advocacy and through what I do with the 2 nonprofits, but just like in my own personal life, the fulfillment and the way my life has become. And even more so than that, circling back to the job, it gives you the ability to understand and maybe have a better or a different perspective of these calls that we go on. When that little girl drowned, I took it very personally. I thought it was my fault, even though she had already passed before we even got there. And I didn't understand for a long time. I questioned, like, why do I keep seeing these horrible things? And the transition has become is I think that we're all put in these positions for a reason, whether we understand them or not. Those children, those families, those situations that we respond to that are out of the ordinary from our everyday calls, I believe we're there for a reason. And the people that go on those calls, even the ones and those of you that are struggling with them, I believe you're meant to be there, not as a punishment, but as a blessing for those people. Because how profound is it that in our day-to-day job, we're in situations where we are in these intense, unbelievable moments for these people. And whether it's to be there with them when they pass, or whether it's be to even make that difference to where they have a little bit more time with family and friends, it's truly a blessing. Like, my biggest struggle with this little girl drowning became my biggest why. I couldn't understand why I had to be there that day, why I had to respond to that call, but she's my reason. She's the reason why I advocate. She's the reason that Skills for Hope began. She's the reason that I became a part of Next Wrong. Like, every single thing that I've done in the past couple of years is not only in her honor, but she motivates me. And if you'd asked me that 10 years ago, I would have laughed and cried at the same time. So I don't know. I think we all have our own struggles and our own journeys. And I think we're very blessed in the job that we do. And we sometimes forget that because of how heavy it can be. But being given these opportunities and being given the ability to have a voice and to have a community that I'm a part of, you included, we wouldn't have met if it wasn't for social media. And I don't know, it's just everything happens for a reason. And I know that sounds cliche, but I really believe that our ups, our downs, it's all part of our journey. It's a matter of what you do with it. And I think that these conversations, these podcasts, these one-on-ones that you have at the fire station or with somebody that you meet and that understands your struggle, even though they're different, they have different calls. We all go on different calls. We all have different feelings. We all have different families. But I think we all boil down to the same thing. There's a reason that they say we have type A personalities, or that we like to party, we like to drink, we go through divorces, we have these troubled relationships. I think it all can be factored back into certain forms of self-medication or just not dealing with the things that we see and being able to process them. It's ridiculous to think that you should be able to go on a call, a child that dies or a massive car accident at 3 a.m. and get off work at 8 a.m. and have a smile on your face and just be a normal person. You have to be able to create this community. You have to be able to tell your family and loved ones, I'm not okay today. Instead of throwing on a face like you do for your patients and act like you're okay and go hide in a corner and do whatever you do to decompress. That's not healthy. The healthy mechanisms are great, but we all know it's very difficult to come home and act normal, but for some reason we still try to do it.
Yeah, we definitely try to act normal. We all come home and we don't want to, I guess maybe the term would be to infect family or infect friends with the bad that we've experienced, but we definitely try to act normal when we're definitely not normal.
Absolutely. And it's just such a strange term to say normal, because I think if we normalize that it's okay to not be okay, if you come home and don't worry about, like you just said, infecting your family members, but saying, hey, I had this horrible call. I'm not going to go into detail, but whether it was a child or a bad car accident or somebody that reminded you of a family member, if you give them the bare bones and let them understand, like, I'm struggling today, if I'm a little short with you, or if I cover up my sadness and my frustration with anger and I lash out, just let me know and I'll do my best, but at least give them an opportunity to understand that there's something wrong and that they'll support you. I've talked to so many spouses and family members that were like, I just wish you would tell me just a little bit and not details. We tell each other our stories in the greatest detail because it's a way for us to let go and release some of it, but we're afraid to do that with family. And just remember, you don't have to. You don't have to tell them details, because people that don't do this job, people that haven't experienced the things that we've experienced, they're not supposed to know what it's like. And as we all know, we don't want them to know what it's like. But if you just tell them, hey, I had a horrible call, I don't really want to talk about it right now, but just give me a little bit of grace, you'd be very surprised how much grace that family member would give you.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because we do like to share those details when we're with each other. And it almost becomes that dark humor with the details.
And oh, absolutely.
You want to add that to a family member. And so you add the details and the dark humor. It's shocking for a family member.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned that you had a therapist before the incident with the little girl, or did you find one after that?
No. Like I said, I've been doing the job total of 19 years. And when I came in, and for a very long time, up until I'd say probably about 3 years ago, in my opinion, it was a huge stigma to talk about it, period. Like, you could talk about the call and, like you said, have the dark humor, but to say, I'm not okay, I'm having a hard time and I'm drinking too much, or I'm getting divorced because my anger issues and my drinking and everything else on piled on top of each other has caused my happy-go-lucky self to change, and the person that loves me or loved me can't anymore because I'm just this different person. You were taught on the job, you suck it up. If you can't do it, then quit. And that was all that it was. And so I very much didn't talk about it. I very much didn't say how much I was struggling with it. And probably about 3 years after that call, it's the most ridiculous thing. I was doing laundry in the laundry room, and I don't know what the trigger was, but I started bawling my eyes out. And it was like, I just couldn't hold it in anymore. And to my then wife, I went and told her, I was like, I need help. Like, I need to go talk to somebody. And one of the most interesting things about counseling is I wanted to go because I wanted to be. And for those 3 years, I was trying to be the person that I was before. I just wanted to go back to that person. And she said the simplest yet most profound thing to me. And she said, you will never, ever be that person again. You can be happy. You can be regular, functioning, and normal. But you're never going to be that same person because trauma changes you. The calls that we go on, the things that we see just in life, you don't have to be a first responder. If part of a bad accident, if you witness a bad accident, if you see somebody get shot, all these crazy things that most people don't end up seeing. But when you do, you have trauma and your life changes. It's what you end up doing with it. But I think we're fixers. We as first responders try to fix things. And so I was constantly looking for a fix. So I'm like, cool, I'm going to counseling now. She's going to give me the tools, like, I'm good to go again. And it's just absolutely not the truth. That's not a bad thing either. It's just the realization that we as fixers do things in absolutes. Mental health is not an absolute. It's constantly evolving, constantly changing. And you have to constantly put in the work. But the difference is this work is worth it. Just, I don't want to say caution. I would say just want to verbalize to people that, like, if you get the help, if you're doing the right things, you're still going to see those calls. You're still going to have to deal with things. And it's about how you deal with it, whether you're going to talk about it, whether you're going to counseling, whether you stay connected. Like, advocacy for me is what keeps me going. It's what keeps me, like, people say, thank you for speaking to us. And it's, no, thank you for having me and letting me get this off my chest and letting me share my story, because selfishly it's just as much for me. But that's the biggest thing they even tell you in recovery, is that you stay sober, you stay on the right path by staying involved, whether it's going to meetings, whether it's advocating, whether it's doing anything that is your why. You have to stay involved. You have to stay connected. And it's like I said, I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to in different parts of the country that our stories are all different. We all come from different backgrounds. We all have seen different things. But when you filter it down, our coping mechanisms, our feelings, our emotions, if you talk to 1, 2, 3, 4 other first responders that have had a pediatric code or seen something horrific happen to a child, especially those, like I said, that have families, our feelings are exactly the same. But what do? We're storytellers. So you tell me about a horrible call that you had, and what's the first thing most of us first responders do? Oh my God, I know what you mean. Let me tell you about the 5 bad calls that I have.
Yeah, one up each other.
And it's not intended.
No.
It's trying to have the brotherhood and say, yeah, I get it too. But what I'm learning to do is I'm learning to listen. Is when somebody tells me that they've had a horrible call, You just listen. You just be a friend. One of the amazing things about NextRung as an organization is we're a peer support team. And we're here to listen. We're here to just, whatever you're going through, we'll be here as your brothers and sisters. We'll listen to you. And you tell us. You direct it. You say, I want to go to counseling. We'll help you get counseling. You say, I just need somebody to hear me out because nobody's listening to me. That's what we'll do. So it goes from something as small as that to needing help with counseling, needing help with possibly going to rehab if that's the journey that you're on. But the great thing is it's just listening, just being a friend. And I think that unintentionally, when others of us are going through trauma, it's part of our recovery process too, to say, oh my God, let me tell you about what I went through as well. And there is a time and a place for that. And I think it's what we do best with each other. But I just know that sometimes people that are down, it can go from them trying to pour their heart out to you to them just closing off yet again because they weren't able to share their story or they weren't able to get everything out, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense, actually. One of the things, and we talked about it before we started recording, is the fact that I try to stay out of the way of people's stories and what they want to say on the show. And part of that is I don't want to do a one-up. I don't want to share a trauma when they're sharing a trauma. There'll come a time for me to share some of my story, but it's not while someone else is sharing their story. And so I completely understand what you're saying there. So you talked about rehab, and you're pretty open about it. You're on your page, you talk about it. You talk about your struggles with staying sober, which has to be an immense amount of struggles at times, especially if you're still in the job. And you talked about, well, how did that work for you? How did you decide? You talked about you took some risk and you figured that it was time to do something, but how'd you reach out?
As far as just admitting I needed to go?
Yeah, and what are the logistics for, you said you found help, and so let's talk about some of that.
As I said, I believe it's out of my character, but some of the people that I've hurt, you could say that they would think the exact opposite, is I was just, because of my addiction to alcohol, because of my self-medicating, I wasn't myself. I didn't have control of my emotions. I was hurtful. I was doing things that were what I believe were out of my character. And you trip up enough times and you make enough mistakes, and I think you either go left or right. You either are going to end up making that big mistake where you hurt yourself or hurt somebody else. And as most of us know, when you do that, obviously it's going to affect you. It's going to affect your job. You're going to lose your job. I think I had just had enough. You create enough chaos and collateral damage in your life, and you have to make a decision. Either you're going to keep going down this road, and let's just say I made it through my career as an alcoholic and I continue down that path. Okay, what's the end goal? What do I do when I don't have this job? Do I just drink every single day till I end up in the medical ICU and end up dying of kidney failure or liver failure? You have to take a step back from your own life. And when I did that, as I told you before, I unfortunately lost three friends to suicide, or two friends and a person that I didn't know, but that was a supporter of Skulls for Hope. And I became friends with their widows, and hearing their intimate details of the home life and the struggles and that they were amazing people, but they had all these things that they couldn't just get past. It was like looking in a mirror. I wasn't as far down that path, but it just, so many things in my life started like glaringly pointing me in the face saying, you have to make a change. And if you don't make a change, then this outcome is not going to be good for you. And I know that had I not gotten the help and I had not gotten sober, I probably wouldn't be here right now. And everybody's journey is different. But for me, I knew that I needed to go to rehab because I had the best intentions. We in this job, if you're drinking and you're drinking heavily, I think you become what we call a functioning alcoholic, where you have to be sober while you're on shift, don't you? So every time I'm on shift, I'm thinking, cool, like at least these 4 days off, I'm going to just not drink. I'm going to do a reset. I'm going to be good to go. And I just couldn't. I just spent every single day, because of habit, because of need, drinking. And I just didn't want to wait for that one gigantic thing, bad thing to happen. And being blessed to be a part of this community, being blessed to be a part of NextRung, I came clean to the founders and I told them, I said, I think I need to go get help. I think I need to go to rehab because this isn't working. And it was very interesting because one of the founders, Blake, I was talking to him and I was so ashamed because I told him, I said, look, I'm a part of this peer support and I can't even help myself. Like, I need to go get help. And he told me something that just kind of broke down all my walls about like accepting the help. And he said, Robert, you already have a story. You already have this amazing journey that you've been on. Imagine how much better it's going to be after you do this. And imagine what it's going to be like to fill from a full cup and not an empty cup. And I think we suffer from that quite a bit in this job, is that we think helping others is helping ourselves, or we think that focusing on others is a way to just not worry about ourselves. But you're running on fumes and something's got to give. And so I knew for me, I had to make that step. I had to take that journey and go to rehab. And like I told you, it saved my life. It's not for everybody. And that's a big thing. I don't want people to think that, oh, I drink a little bit when I'm off duty and maybe I need to go to rehab. Everybody has to go at their own journey. And for me, it was an absolute. I was just at a point where for years before I went to rehab, I wanted to just get to a point where I could have a couple beers with friends. And it just didn't work for me. But what I learned in rehab for my personal journey was that it was a medication for me. It wasn't even an enjoyable thing anymore in my life. And that's what I reflect on now. It's not a struggle to stay sober for me because I figured out my why. I figured out why I was self-medicating and what I needed to do. What I will tell you is the day-to-day struggle that I do have is as horrible as it would feel the next day. The self-medicating and the numbing and the escaping and not having to feel in those moments, it's hard to replace that when you don't have that vice, when you have to feel and you have to go through those emotions. But I can tell you, as exhausting as that is, it slowly gets better every single time. And if you create that support system of friends, of family members, like you, for instance, I know, and we've had that discussion that we haven't met in person. We really don't know each other that well, but I know for a fact that if I'm struggling, I can reach out to you. And that goes for so many other people that I know. And part of Skulls for Hope and part of what I do is it's an online diary, is I just share my pain. I share my struggles because it hurts and because I don't know what to do and I don't know how to deal with it sometimes. And this community always picks me up and always reminds me that, hey, I needed to hear that today too, or I know exactly how you feel. And just not feeling alone is the biggest saving grace for me personally. And I think not numbing is the daily struggle, but I learned enough in my own personal journey that I just know what'll happen. I know that even today, if I were to pick up a beer, it wouldn't stop with that. And it's just because I wouldn't see the point. I wouldn't see the point of cool. Like, I'm just enjoying this social time with my friends. It's okay. I need another and I need another and I need another because I want that feeling and I want that euphoria. But with that euphoria obviously comes, and I can't speak for everybody, but I know for me, I could be having a great time. But the more that I drank, the darker my thoughts would become. And I'd end up in a very depressive state, or I'd end up in this place of helplessness that I couldn't get out of because obviously I wasn't in my right mind. And so it's just an absolute for me. It's not for everybody, but I know that for my personal journey and for others that I've spoken to, that's the why. That's why we don't drink anymore. And to be honest with you, it's almost more of a challenge and more, I don't want to say exciting, but every single day you do that is just a better and better day. And I think I just mentioned to you the ability to share my story, the fact that I'm not hiding behind advocacy or the job or picking up overtimes to not deal, as exhausting as it can be. It's beyond rewarding. What we do through peer support and what we do through advocacy is so fulfilling, and it's such an amazing thing to just meet other people that have been on the same or that are struggling with the same thing and are absolutely not okay with being public about it, which is understandable, but that can listen to these podcasts so they can go to the Skulls for Hope, or they can reach out to Next Rung and know that they're in a confidential space and just share. And that's huge.
You just finished talking about Next Rung. Why don't you explain a little bit about Next Rung? We don't need to go too in-depth because I think that could be a show in itself to talk to the guys from Next Rung, including yourself. Absolutely. Again about it. But maybe if you can just touch on some of what they do and what they offer, maybe how it was started, and we'll just cover some of that real quick.
So as far as how it started, I'm going to leave that to the founders, Blake and Charlie. But what I can tell you is I met Blake probably, gosh, I don't want to even mess that up. It's been years. But
time flies, right?
We still to this day have not met, but I can't tell you how much I love him and how much I consider him literally a brother. He is a godsend. He's just been there. He's been amazing. And what was great about him is the three tenets of Next Rung is family, faith, family, and first responders. And it's a Christian-based organization, which we don't necessarily throw out there. But one of the great things about it with him was that he's like, your faith, whatever you're going through, is your own journey. I know who you are. I believe in who you are. And I think I want you to be a part of this organization. And what's been great about it is my faith has continued to grow because of the things that I've seen. I know that for over a decade, I was very angry at God. I didn't understand why he would let certain things happen, why we would see certain things. And so I had this tumultuous relationship, and it was the funniest thing. And again, when I say all this is my journey, not anybody else's, but I realized that it's above my pay grade. Like, I don't make these decisions. I met people and heard stories of people that were in the church or Christians and pastors, and they lost their children. And I'm like, oh my God, like, how do you even do that? How do you, I have my own problems with believing in faith, and you, yet here you are preaching and you lost your child. And it's not up to us. We don't make these decisions. I think my mistake I made as a first responder is I thought I was saving people. I thought that I would make that difference. And an amazing officer I worked with told me, we don't save anybody. We buy time, whether it's 5 minutes, whether it's 3 weeks so family can say goodbye to somebody, or 10 years because somebody had a heart attack. We all eventually die. And so my faith grew and grew. And to get back to Next Rung, all this stuff combined together. But the big thing that we do is peer support. It's just a support line, whether you can reach out over text, over a phone call. It's what we do with CISD. It's what we do in our own departments, where we say, hey, here's the peer support team. Here's the line. But we're nationwide and we're here just to listen. And like I said, it's confidential. It's this thing where anybody across the country can reach out and just share their struggles, share their stories, share what they're going through. And we're just here to be that lifeline, to be that extra helping hand to whatever your journey is. It can be something as simple as just having a really quick phone call, just once. It can turn into, and there's people that are a part of Next Rung that have been calling the line or reaching out that I've given my personal number to, that I'm friends with now, that we regularly talk, and it's building that brotherhood. It's just letting people know that they have family here, and it grows all the way to what I did. If you need to go to rehab, if you don't have the funding to pay for that, or you don't know how to, the first step of doing that, we're there to help you with that. If you want to go to counseling, but you're afraid to reach out or you don't know who to speak to, we'll do that for you. And it's funny to me because there's quite a few people that haven't heard about Next Rung. And it always catches me off guard because we're free, we're here, we're your brothers and sisters, and we're waiting. We're waiting to talk to you. We're waiting to help you. It's just taking that first step. And what's nice, like I said, I've mentioned it multiple times, but all of it's confidential. Everything we speak about, if you say you have a drinking problem, et cetera, we don't go past being a friend. We don't say, we're going to have to do this, we're going to have to do that. If we're worried about you, obviously we're going to take the necessary steps to help you. But we're here for you, not against you. And that's huge. I think that we get worried that when we talk to admin, when we talk to our higher ups, that there's a stigma that's going to be placed on us, or that we're going to be pulled from the job, or X, Y, and Z. And people need to understand that if you start taking those steps on your own, it's all going to work out. But the important thing is just taking that first step and asking for help. And I think we should be trying to end the stigma of it being a weakness. I think it shows a huge amount of resolve and strength to reach out at all. And that's what Next Rung is for, is to be there when you reach out.
What's the easiest way for people to reach out to Next Rung? Is it online? Is it by phone? What's the easiest?
Whatever works for you. Honestly, a lot of people reach out to us through social media. If you want to call us, we have a phone number that you can reach out to. The website, if you go to nextrung.org, you can go there. You can text support to 1-833-698-7864. It's whatever is easiest for you. Some people prefer to talk on the phone. Some people prefer to text. Some people prefer just to go onto the website and kind of peruse around it. But if you go to the website, it'll explain the why, the resources, and what you can do.
And I'll link to that in the show notes so people can find it pretty easily from here. And then also, if they have Instagram, they can find it at Next Rung on Instagram, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
So that's pretty simple. Let's talk about some of your family history.
I grew up in Albuquerque. I've been here 31 years. Prior to that, I was a military brat, so we moved around quite a bit, but I definitely call this place home, and this obviously where I've spent my entire first responder career.
All right, so you moved around quite a bit before that?
Previously, I was born in England. We lived in Sacramento, San Antonio, and then ended up here.
Oh, so not too many places, but enough to get some movement.
No.
It's always been EMS, or how's it work in your department?
It's EMS and fire in my department. For me personally, I did a ride-along on a fire truck, loved it, and I knew that's what I wanted to do, but EMS was not even on my radar. But in our department, I'd say the majority of our calls are EMS. And as I started my journey, when I was a basic, I did that for about 5 years, and I enjoyed it a lot, but I started noticing on cardiac arrests or bad calls or things like that, I would watch paramedics and just seeing the amount of tools that they had and then the things that they would do, starting IVs, pushing medications, I realized I wanted to go that route, and that's what I wanted to do. And so I did. I've been a paramedic now for about 14 years. I've been a lieutenant for, I think, a little over 5 or 6, and I'm going to stay a paramedic lieutenant until I retire.
And how far is retirement?
2.5 years.
Oh, so that's easy.
Yeah. The light at the end of the tunnel.
Let's talk about some of the things that you would suggest people start today. What can they do today? So people are starting to feel some stress, starting to feel anxiety. What are some key things that you think people can start to do today to start to alleviate some of that?
To take a deep breath and realize you're not weak. You're not the only person going through this struggle. You're not the only person that's in pain or suffering. But so many of us are suffering next to each other and not saying a word, where that weight of the world that you feel like nobody understands, or your peers and the lieutenant you work for, the captain you work for, that they feel nothing, that nothing affects them. And for whatever reason, it's affecting you. Like, I promise you, it affects all of us in different ways, mind you. Some people handle this completely fine. I've talked to people. I had a very good childhood. I was upper middle class. My family's always been amazing. And I don't know that I was prepared personally to see some of the things that I did or how to process it. But I've noticed that a lot of people that do this job that have had a very traumatic childhood or have been through a lot prior to the job, this is like par for the course, or easier for them to deal with. But even those people are an amazing resource of, hey, like, life can be hard, things can be hard, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel and you're not alone. But I think for those people that are starting that, it doesn't matter if it's the peer support line at Next Strong. It doesn't matter if it's your coworker that you know and love and trust. It doesn't matter if it's a complete stranger that you believe might understand it, like me. I always mention that. You're always welcome to reach out. I'm always going to be here. If I am not able to talk at the moment, we'll figure it out. But it's just letting that person know that they're not alone. Again, and it's not a sales pitch. It's just that was the point of the bracelets, was that for that particular individual, if he wasn't ready to do anything, he could anonymously order a bracelet. He could wear that bracelet. And when he's struggling, she's struggling, they know that they're a part of a community, or that they're understood, or that they're not alone on this journey for however it takes. But the one thing I have to say is people always need to understand their journey is their own. It goes as fast as you want, as slow as you want. I would love to help somebody avoid the pitfalls completely, but I think that's very difficult to do. I would just caution and say, whenever you're ready, we're here. And whenever you're ready to talk, we're here to help you start the conversation.
Those few points that are key. Let's accept the fact that we are all struggling at some point, and we should all normalize that and talk about it. One of the things we tried to do around fire departments and my station specifically is to open it up to where it's okay to just talk. Pull one person aside and talk. It's okay to check in with a coworker if that coworker looks like something's wrong. I know that I've had plenty of people pull me aside before and say, hey, what's going on today? And it's appreciated beyond anything. You can't explain when someone reaches out, and that's good. That's a great thing.
No, I completely agree. And it sounds cliche, but I have a veteran friend of mine that he's really good at it, because we don't want to burden people with our issues. We don't want to burden people with our problems. And I saw him at the gym the other day, and I have my ups and downs. I have my struggles. This is not all sunshine and rainbows. And he's, hey, how are you? And I'll tell everybody right now, if I say I'm good, then I'm probably not really that good. but it's just the cliche that I'm good, I'm good. And he knows that. And he looked at me and says, okay, how is Robert? And it sounds silly, but it opened that door. And I was like, you know what? I'm okay. And this is what's going on, as simple as I think it is, or as not, it's not a huge deal, but, and there's always a but. And I told him like what was going on in my day and what was going on in my life. And I gave more than a, I'm good. It was a very short conversation, but it was very freeing. It was very comfortable. And it was just the simple thing of, okay, but how is Robert? And it just caught me off guard. But I've tried to implement that with my friends, with my peers, where I think we can all generally tell when we're not good, but we say we're good. And we don't have to push it. We don't have to keep pushing somebody saying, you need to tell me exactly how you feel. But if you ask them just to readdress themselves and really understand like that it's okay to not be okay, even if you can't pinpoint it, but that you're not alone in that struggle, that can be the gist of the entire conversation.
That's a fantastic way of personalizing it. It sounds so simple, but I can see how that works, and it should work well, because it's so easy, like you said, to say I'm good. Or in my case, I love to say, someone asked me how I'm doing, I'm like, just fantastic. And because that can come off any way you want it to. And
absolutely.
And it puts people at, it almost puts people at ease, or it keeps them at arm length enough to not get real. But when you personalize it, it's almost impossible not to get real.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like that. I start doing some of that myself. So that's a good little nugget. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we get to the last two questions of the day?
No, like I said, I love doing these things and having these conversations because it's a start. Like, all this is a start. You're going to do so many more podcasts, talk to so many more people and evolve. And that's how I feel this always goes, is that you want to leave something on the table. And if there isn't something that somebody heard that just really caught on to them, or if there's something that started here that they just want to know more about, what do? They're going to reach out to you. They're going to reach out to me. They're going to reach out to Next Rung and be more inquisitive. And I think that's how we do this. And it's how we grow, is having these conversations and unintentionally or not leaving something on the table to where it can be talked about later, or it can be like, this started the fire inside me to get that help. And I want to know more.
That's wonderful. I love that idea to, like you said, okay, I've got a question that makes me reach out, because I've reached out to you with questions before and it started more conversations. So that's always been appreciated. So then let's wrap up with my two final questions I like to ask everybody. Talk about an everyday carry, since the title of the show is The Things We All Carry. And we know that's all emotional, what we're talking about normally, but let's talk about something physical that you carry day in and day out. Something you feel naked without?
But without my bracelets. Honestly, like I said, probably for the last 11 years, I've personally had them. It became a business about 5 years ago, as far as starting the conversation and a nonprofit. But to me, I just have to have the bracelet. It's an extension of me. And if I'm not wearing it, I do feel naked.
I personally have three of these. I think that I'm pretty rough on them. And you probably roll your eyes every time I contact you. I have two of them on my lunchbox that I carry to work every day, and then one on my wrist all the time. It's the one thing that really just doesn't come off of my body unless I want to hold it and use it as a meditation bead, or because I'll play them out as I just sit and think, and it just keeps me busy.
And that's exactly what they're for. But especially those malas, that was created because I would wear it in counseling. And as I was talking and fidgeting, I call them my adult fidget spinners, but it's basically something I had to play with.
That makes sense, because that's naturally where my hand goes. So I just slide it off my wrist and do that. And I just find myself sitting there and mindlessly, and it just turns into a meditation. So it's perfect. So what's the website where they can get the bracelets?
Yeah, you can go to www.skullsforhope.com. And that's the website that we're continuing to build and grow. You can also go to either Facebook or Instagram at Skulls for Hope, and there'll be a link that you can go there. And one of the things a lot of people do is you can just arbitrarily order one. If you have some that means something to you, like a certain color, things like that, we can't always promise, and it's not something we do regularly. But if you go on to the social media page, and you go through Instagram and you see some of the bracelets on there and they speak to you, or you like that color, or you like the design, you're always welcome to message us and we'll see what we can take care of. But at the very least, you get an idea of what they look like and what they are.
I know for a fact that I've special ordered three different ones from you, and you've not blinked an eye, and you've fulfilled them without any kind of question. So I appreciate that. So next thing I'd like to ask is something you want to suggest to people. I kind of like it to be a book, but if it's not a book, then a person or even another podcast, a movie, something that you'd like to put out there to say, hey, check this out.
Probably maybe the only first responder that'll say this, or very few of us, but I don't know if you've heard of the author, Brené Brown.
Yes.
So a friend had just pushed and pushed for me to read any of her books, and I fought it for so long, and I don't know why. Maybe it was the cliche stigma or just saying, why do I want to go to a self-help book or something like that. And the big thing for me was that she just speaks so much volumes to me as a first responder and as a person. And one of the books that I read, well, the first one that I read in treatment was called Braving the Wilderness. And it's the quest for true belonging and the courage to stand alone. And the big thing I feel is, even though we're a community, we do still stand alone. We do still have these struggles that we have to have the ability and the, I guess you'd call it the resoluteness to stand on our own. One of the things she says is strong back, soft front. And I really gravitated towards that because you don't have to, it's not a weakness, it's a strength. But to show kindness, to be vulnerable, to stand on your own two feet for what you believe in spite of the rumors, in spite of people talking badly about you for or saying you're weak because they're not ready to deal with their own struggles. It's easy to say. It's unbelievably hard to do. And so her books have softened me a little bit.
That's awesome. I would not have expected that her to come up as the author, but I appreciate it. And I'm a link to that also in the show notes. I'm going to cover Skulls for Hope, Next Rung, your website for the bracelets and the book. And it'll all be in the show notes for listeners to find. And if my listeners and my followers aren't following you, I hope that they find you on Instagram and find Next Rung and add you to the list, because I think they're both well worth following, and the mission is unbelievable, and I hope you guys keep going at it.
Absolutely.